Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 329. Well, welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Turlow. I serve as pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And with me once again is Rob McKenzie. Rob is on the other side of the screen in his palatial estate on this beautiful, warming spring day. How's it going?
Good. It is beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It's green. We were, Melody and I were talking this morning. We're looking at all the green, and I did comment to her how happy I am that all the green is back to hide any view of any neighbors.
So you can't see through the trees anymore, and everything becomes secluded. Yes. It also provides shade and prettiness too, right, Rob?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those,
all those things.
That's what Melody was happy about. You know,
yes. It is. It is a wonderful, you know, throughout my life, I've always enjoyed winter.
Okay.
And you know, others in my life have not. So like when I was growing up, it was winter, you know, we skied a lot, not downhill, but cross country up in New York. And so I liked outdoor activities. But I married into a family that was a West Coast and Hawaii family, and they did not. So to do any type of winter sports meant, or winter activities even, meant I would do them on my own. But over the years, that has decreased my desire to be outdoors in the winter. I think as it happens for a lot of people as they get a little bit, maybe it's either older or wiser. I'm not sure.
So I always think it's funny when somebody admits that as like a, and I'm using air quotes here, fun hobby, is cross-country skiing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like skiing with all the fun taken away.
No, I just really enjoyed it. I mean,
there's only two reasons why you should be cross country skiing. One, you're trying to escape like barren wilderness, or two, you're in the biathlon in the Olympics. Those are the only two reasons why cross country skiing should be a thing.
Rob, have you ever done it?
Cross country?
Yeah.
No, but I have skied.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Where you take the cool little lift up to the top, and then you go down at 100 miles an hour and try to stop before you hit something. Now that's fun. Challenging, you know, it's, I mean, look, sometimes some people don't make it, and that's just nature's way.
That was me the first time I crossed, downhill skied.
Downhill skied.
Yeah. They were bringing me over to this is with my in-laws and such. So they did do some winter sports, but first time I got on the bunny hill, and I kind of like started moving in the wrong direction, and I started going down the wrong way, and all of a sudden I hear in the background no, and I just kept going, and I just see all these people like uh-oh, and then I see a thing that had black diamonds on it, and I was like, what? And I knew that wasn't good. And so I did one of those, you know, emergency stops, which meant falling
you
on my
down.
Behind. And then had to walk my way back up. But anyway, I think those all started by saying how much I appreciate spring now.
Right. Yes.
And the warming up. But, you know, and going on walks. We walk, you know, with Tippy, the beast. She actually does go on walks. She doesn't always eat people. It's only when Rob comes over. Going on walks with Tiffany, my wife, and seeing the beauty, seeing the different flowers, some are just so beautiful, and Sarah helps me see those in a really delightful way. So it's spring is coming, and I like it. And I planted a tree today or yesterday. I planted a tree, river birch tree. Okay. Yes,
a river birch.
River
because
birch.
You live by a river.
No, it doesn't have to be by a river. It's just a name, Rob. Well, come on.
So it's just then it's called a birch.
No, I mean, there are white birch, there are gray birch, there are river birch. There are other birch too, but those are the only three I can remember offhand.
where in your backyard did you plant it?
Actually, it's on the side of the house in that like wild section.
Where the poison ivy was?
Yes, where the poison ivy
was. Still is? Is it still there?
It probably is there, but I didn't, like, it's not.
It's like you were.
It's not out in full force right now.
It's like you were cultivating it.
The poison ivy?
It was like you were encouraging.
there was definitely a lot of poison ivy.
There was a lot of poison
when ivy. When it gets going, but hopefully not this year. I'm going to be working on it to tame it. I am going to be subduing the earth, well, at least a very small portion of it.
Good.
Yes.
That's good.
Yes. So, what are you doing out there in your wild backyard? Because you have much more property to tame than I do.
I do.
You did it to yourself.
Oh, I know. But it's very nice to be out here in the boonies.
Yes.
Odd, having grown up in the city, yes. To be out here in the boonies. It still is odd to me.
I'm sure. You spent 100 years there and you've only been here, what, two, three?
Three, yeah. Yes, I'm 103. That's fine. No problem with that. Actually, I tried to kill myself yesterday. Because I was ambitious and mowed half the yard, and I have a push. Everybody keeps telling me to get a riding mower, and I'm like, "That's the coward's way out."
It's either a coward's way out or it's the wise way out. you can be having that glass of wine whilst doing the lawn.
I don't know if that's wisdom there, but okay, we'll go with that.
Ice cold wine, Rob, while you're mowing the lawn.
You can have my slushy rosé.
There you go.
Rosé slushy.
There you go.
There you go. So I got ambitious yesterday and I mowed half of my property,
quite a bit.
which is quite a bit. And then I walked in, I took a shower and I sat on the couch and then prayed for death. So that's been my day.
That was a beautiful day though. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
But all right.
Speaking of praying for death,
So that's how you're going to segue. I was trying to think of something to segue into Daniel. I was going to say, well, speaking of taming the land, and I don't know if that was going to work or not. But
yeah, No. Mine didn't work either, but mine was closer. So we
all right, everybody. Daniel. We're doing Daniel.
We are doing Daniel. We're in Daniel 2, and which is one of the more famous chapters of the Bible, one of the famous stories. This is one that is really good for Sunday school because you can have kids draw things and they can color, and it's really good because they make what do you do as a good conservative churchman? You give your children pictures of idols that they can then color, and then they can show their parents later. Look what we did! There's a giant idol. But they need something to color. But why don't you read? Up to verse 11?
Yeah. 11. So Daniel chapter 2, beginning at verse 1. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb. And your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. That's Daniel 2, 1 through 11.
I mean, we all know the story. This is, it's always interesting in scripture to go over things that we really know and try to look at it from different angles and what can we learn at this point. This seems to be something that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, that Nebuchadnezzar would have a dream and he would call them in to interpret. This seems to be something that he did. I don't know if often's the right word, but a pattern that, and not just Nebuchadnezzar, but as we'll learn later, this is something that all kings do. This is a practice of kings. Dreams in and of themselves were very important. We are talking about a time when things were more mystical in nature. I know that one of the things that Tolkien always talked about when it came to modern day was that forests used to be very mystical and you didn't know what was in them. And so there were great story plots and as far as writing goes, but also in day-to-day life, the idea that, you know, this is why, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, what happens to her? She goes into the woods and you have all these other, you know, Sir Gawain, the Green Knight, he goes on a quest and he eventually he's going through wooded lands. And whenever Tolkien always brings this out that fairies, which are natural to the wooded world, draw you in. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that you are looking for. It's something that you're drawn into. And so that, you know, lasts all the way up until the late 1800s, early 1900s, as far as how we understand the physical world, that there's this mysticalness to it. It's only now in the last 100 years that the modern world has taken away a lot of the mysticism of the woods, the enchantment, the mystery is really, when I say mysticism, I'm talking mystery. So when you go back to, what is this, you know, 575 or now or 560 or whatever it was, that's the setting that people are in, this idea of mystery within the world. And dreams was something that people often looked at far more than we do. I actually dream very vividly. I dream every night. I often remember my dreams. Melody doesn't. Mm-hmm. So sometimes she does, but she does dream every night, but she doesn't usually remember them. It's something that, but if you're somebody that has vivid dreams that you're remembering all the time, it becomes part of who you are. It's more than, I mean, when I go to bed each night, I'm looking forward to the fact that I'm going to be dreaming. And yet I'm in the modern world. So I know that this is my subconscious. This is things I might watch on TV or read in books or have conversations about or things like that. That's all playing within my mind as I'm dreaming. But if you don't have that understanding of subconscious and you're just looking at dreams as something that enter your thought from the outside, which is much more common to think of, that I mean, you can look at people within medieval times that would look at dreams as being something that either a devil or an angel put into your mind while you're asleep. Mm-hmm. And that, it's just that's how they were looking at it. And so dreams were very, now this isn't medieval times, but still it can show you how people react to dreams when they're living in a more mystical world. And so for Nebuchadnezzar, when he would have dreams that were so vivid and interesting and bothered him, he would call for the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and Chaldeans. And you know, in one sense, that's what they were paid for, right? They were to come to him, and he would tell them the dream, and they would interpret it. And it's the same thing. It kind of falls in the same category as reading the tea leaves or what the chicken bones, you scatter the bones, and then you read them. And so it is very, you know, kind of sorcery, witchcraft kind of mystical realm. But he calls these people to him. This isn't a new thing. This is something that not only he, but other kings or rulers in the ancient world would do. And when I was reading this, though, I mean, I understand magicians, enchanters, mm-hmm. sorcerers, but the Chaldeans seem to kind of like one of these things is not like the other. The Sesame Street.
Well, yeah. Right. So that's because, you know, the word Chaldeans is used elsewhere in the scriptures, right? To refer, generally we see it to just the Babylonians, just generally the Babylonians, mm-hmm. right. the Chaldeans. But it's also understood that the Chaldeans, were like, I've seen it in a different translation. It's just, translated as wise men. But the Chaldeans, is a part of the Babylonian Empire. It's like a descriptive term for a particular group. And, some of them were known for their expertise in the, you know, the magic lore, the interpreting of dreams and so on and so forth. There was wisdom in their education, the wise men, right? You might even associate them with those that come to, Jesus, at later in time. Now, obviously different, right. but that type of figure. And, you know, I don't know the details specifically, but if they are a group of people that come from a particular region of the Babylonian Empire, then you know that this is something that has likely been that's like a family affair, right? So there's mm-hmm. it's something where, you know, it's passed down from generation to generation of how to do this. And, you know, some of it, I'm sure, was trickery. Some of it was making things up. Some of it was probably demonic. So there's all sorts of different things going on here, but we know, as you were saying earlier, just to reiterate, we know that this is something that was relatively common in the sense that, the expectation is that, that there is an expectation. So when the king calls these men in there's an expectation of what he's going to do. He's going to tell us the dream. We're going to give him interpretation, and we're good to go. But he messes things up. He's like, you know what? I'm getting sick and tired of, you know, paying you guys all this money and, you know, getting these little, you know, dream interpretations that I don't know. They might not be on par. So you know what? I'll know that you guys know what you're talking about. You tell me what I dreamed. Yeah,
it is interesting that he pulls this on him. I mean, you're right that the Chaldeans it's from, I think, the southern Babylon is where the region of the Chaldeans were. Nebuchadnezzar himself was actually from there. He was a Chaldean. So he's, you know, these people were known for their wisdom, for their study. And that's part of the reason why later on we're going to see in the reply there, it's the Chaldeans who talk to him. And probably partly is that they're kind of related to him. And they're the ones who could get away with it, or at least they think they can. They can't, but they're the ones who, you know, you can see the other guys over there going, you talk to him. You know, I'm not going to say anything. You talk to him. you know, because I mean, this is an odd request. This is something that they didn't expect. And which shows you several things. One, Nebuchadnezzar was kind of, he kind of knew the whole time that when they would interpret his dreams, that they were guessing. He knew that. They're guessing at this. But this dream that, I don't know if he had this for several nights, it very well could be it was a recurring dream over a short period of time. It could be that he had it that night, woke up, went back to bed, had the same dream, woke up, mm-hmm. Eventually he couldn't get back to sleep. That this dream bothered him so much that it seems to have been something different. He didn't recognize this as the normal dream that he would have. Because if mm-hmm. he did, he would have called these people in and he would have said, all right, you know, here's my dream. Give me your interpretation. Yeah. Like he always has done.
Right. Right. And
but this time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, yeah.
This time.
Yeah. Okay. You know, I mean, it's straight there, right? His spirit was troubled, but not just that his spirit was troubled, but that it was troubled in such a degree that his sleep left him. is the language that's being used. And we know the need for sleep. We know what it feels like. And so I can only assume, even when he is explaining this to those he's called in, he says, I had a dream and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. So something about it, the way in which it, you know, I mean, when you read through it, when we get to the dream, right, it's okay, it's interesting, but why does it bother him so much? Right. What is it that really captures him in such a way that troubles him? And so there's something within it, embedded within it, that, you know, first we do know that this is a dream that is given to him. So this is something that is put upon him from an outside source. This is not the subconscious doing its thing that we're familiar with. You know, I'm glad you dream a lot. I'm more on Melody's side, where I if I dream, I rarely ever remember them. And I mean, I do dream, I know that, but because I do remember them on occasion. But it's very rare that I, you know, wake up and say, oh, I had this awesome dream. That's like my daughter, such a vivid imagination, that on the way to school driving, she's like, let me tell you my dream. So she's just always wants to talk about her dreams. And she's been doing this for, you know, 10 years, almost every day has a dream that she wants to describe to you. So, it's, you know, there are those people, that's the subconscious, you know, all sorts of things and imagination going on, but this is something different. This is something that has been put on him to trouble him, such that he couldn't ignore it. I mean, he could try, right? Maybe he did try. And the more he ignored it, the more it came upon him that this is just hurting him. He's got no sleep. He's got no rest. He can't function properly. And so that's what's going on here, right? I mean, you got to get in the sense of what would draw a king, to this point where he calls all of these people in, and then puts such a high mark on it. You tell me the dream or else I'm going to tear you limb from limb. So, you know, I mean, obviously he's an evil man, so he doesn't care for human life very much.
Yeah, it's very subtle.
But
very subtle.
Yeah, but he's just like, I'm done with cheaters. You know, I'm done with the being conned by you guys. And, if you can't tell me the dream, you're dead. So, and obviously this has not been done to these enchanters before. And these wise men, these Chaldeans, the sorcerers, because they're stunned by this. No one can do this. Not a human in all of your kingdom can do this. No one can do this. So it's quite fascinating. And I'm sure, you know, someone has done some type of psychological interpretation of this to try to read between the lines, even more than we just did. But yeah, it's pretty wild.
That's, you know, again, that's why they're back there and they're conferring amongst themselves and they're saying, what are we going to do? And they're looking at the Chaldean saying, you talk to him. You know, you're related to him. So maybe you can get away with it. And actually their answer to him is very reasonable. I mean, think about it. You want us to tell you what your dream was? No, that's not what we do. You pay us to interpret the dream, not to tell you what the dream was. I mean, there's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand for, you know, no great. This is the most honest they've ever been with Nebuchadnezzar.
No, we can't do it.
We can't do this. What you ask, you know, there's no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. In other words, not us. We're not gods.
We're not. Yeah. And to a certain extent, revealing that they have actually no access to gods either. Right. You know, you'd think they might try to make it up, you know, but they can't.
They can't.
Right. Because the king, you know what? The king already knows what he dreamed. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, can't do it.
Right. No amount of guessing. You'd have to be a really good guesser to come up with exactly what Nebuchadnezzar dreamed. You know, and they could have come, what did you have for dinner last night? And we could try to figure something out. But it is pure exasperation of just, I mean, they're coming to him saying, we can't do this. Only the gods could do this. And no human being could do this. what you're asking is actually unreasonable. And Nebuchadnezzar's response is interesting for a number of reasons, but it's not like Nebuchadnezzar sits here and says, "You're right. You're absolutely right. This is unreasonable." Because, by the way, it kind of is to a degree. Although the enchanters, the sorcerers, so you have the people who are in touch with the other side, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't they be able to tell him his dream? If dreams are coming from outside in the enchanted world, then shouldn't the sorcerers and enchanters be able to tell him what it is? Well, theoretically, based on their reputation, they should. But okay, if they can't, Chaldeans are the wisest people. They study a lot. So shouldn't they be able to tell him his dream? And of course, they can't. But he doesn't come back to them and say, "You're right. This is an unreasonable request." He says no. He becomes furious.
Yeah.
Actually, here. Why don't you read the yeah. 12 through 16?
Yeah. Just to finish off this section, beginning at verse 12. Just read through 16 here. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king.
Yeah, it's Nebuchadnezzar's like, "Look, this is what I pay you for. This is what your reputation is built on, that you're the wisest people in the land, and you're in touch with the enchanted world. I'm calling you to the carpet. Tell me what my dream was."
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can't, you're going to die. It really shows you how troubled Nebuchadnezzar was. He was desperate to find out the interpretation of the dream.
Yeah, he's desperate, but he's also mad, right? I mean, not mad like he'll be later, but right. He's furious, he's angry, and he's murderous, right? I'm just gonna kill all the wise men. You know, I'm fed up with these guys. I'm just gonna kill them all. So I mean. And apparently, right? I mean, we don't know this yet. I mean, thus far, Daniel and his friends are just servants in the temple, right? They are those that have been well educated. We know, right? They're families of royals in some way from Judah, and they've been brought over. They're living in the king's residence and palace. They eat the king's Well, they don't eat the king's food, but they eat their own food, and they live among those in the palace. But this is the first time that we're being told that they're considered or numbered among the wise men, or those that can do these things, right, such that they would be a part of the king's edict to kill everyone, right?
Right. Well, I mean, all means all. We finished up last chapter one, with them graduating and coming before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar being so impressed with them and their answers that they were, top of their class.
Yeah, and found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in his kingdom. Yeah. So I guess there's a statement that would suggest that they are numbered among them. That's my fault, from lack of record,
right,
lack of memory.
But they're not. But you notice that they're not there.
Yeah.
Which I mean, now we can only kind of speculate, why weren't they there? Probably because because they were new, they had just graduated, and it very well could be that the enchanters and sorcerers and, you know, Chaldeans, how this normally works in any kind of culture is that they just hadn't been accepted into the main group.
Mm-hmm.
They when they were called, nobody told them, because they weren't part of the political structure that would, you know, nobody thought to bring them in because they were, well, these Israelites that yeah, we don't need them, you know. But so that they're not there. But again, this is all, of course, in the providence of God.
Yeah,
they weren't there.
Right. But to a certain extent, it's speculation as well, because there are obviously a number of them that are a number of these enchanters, magicians, wise men, whatever, that aren't called in as well. Right. There's several throughout his kingdom that it's not as though he calls them in and they all come. Right. So there's too much that we don't know about how these things worked, how many people are involved.
There could have been a rotation.
Yeah, goodness, we don't. Yeah, I mean, these poor guys, the poor guys, the guys that I'm going to tear you limb from limb. Tell me unless you tell me.
I wasn't even there. Yeah, it seems like when we understand political court that there is kind of a hierarchy that comes up. So Daniel and his friends just might not have been around long enough to even be in the hierarchy, and that would have been part of the group that would just naturally go part of that section of court that would have gone to the king on command. We don't exactly know, but basically, you know, the Arioch is coming in and telling them, okay, you guys have to be killed now. Sorry about this. But you have to be killed. And of course, Daniel and his friends are wondering why they're going to be killed. And Daniel replies, you know, with prudence and discretion that, you know, he's like, look, I know that you're supposed to kill everybody. This is the king's edict. But why so quickly? What's going on that this has to be done so quickly? I mean, again, it goes back to Nebuchadnezzar's desperation, I think. Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, I mean, what was he going to do? He was going to kill all the wise men, everybody in his, including the Chaldeans, who are his kin. He's going to kill all of them, or at least all the ones that are in this position. And what is he going to do then? He's just killed all his advisors. Is he going to get more? I don't think he's thought that this through.
No, I mean, he seems to be acting hasty, of course.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the king was angry and very furious. So, I mean, even the description of him is not he was angry. It's not he was very furious. He's angry and very furious, right? I mean, so it gives a sense of the urgency, as you've been hinting at, not hinting, you've been saying. And more than likely, just the rashness, the coming very quickly to a call and, hey, I'm king. I can do whatever I want. I'm ticked off. You guys aren't doing what I need to get done. So I'm done with you all. And you know what? If I ever need one of these guys again, I'll just conquer another land and get them. You know,
Right. I mean, was there a B group? You know, was there like
a minor league
sorcerers and all of them? They're just going to call them up and okay, you're on the hill tonight.
Yeah, I mean that's what the king does, but what does Daniel do? Let's be reasonable about this. Why so urgent?
Yeah.
Arioch makes the whole matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king. I mean, he had some type of relationship in such a way or status that he could go in at the requested time of the king and speak to him about how he was going to. Now, notice it just says interpretation, show the interpretation mm-hmm. to the king. It doesn't say that he was going to show him the dream, or what he dreamed, at least not yet.
Right. I mean, we know he will, but it's interesting. He does. There's Daniel was just an extraordinary person that he was able to go into the king, and we don't know if he went directly to the king himself,
sure. Yeah.
Or if he went in and talked to one of the king's advisors and the message was delivered. We don't know, but either way, Daniel was able to get time so that he can interpret the dream. And the fact that first he calls everyone, Nebuchadnezzar, first he calls everyone, tells them to do this. He's so desperate, he wants them. He asks them something that no king asks, for them to tell him the dream. Then he's ready to kill them so quickly. But now he's ready to okay, well, I wasn't going to kill everybody. Now I'll wait. And I'll give this guy time. It really just shows you that he just wanted to know, and it shows you how much it bothered him. And knowing the book of Daniel, and of course knowing the dream, which we'll talk about next week, what it means and everything that happened, we know it's the Lord behind all of this. The Lord is the one that is giving the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and giving it in such a way that Nebuchadnezzar's kind of going a little crazy over it.
He
pushes Nebuchadnezzar to the point where Nebuchadnezzar demands that, because he has to know the answer. That's the number one thing. He has to know what this dream means. And he's going to make sure that the people that tell him what it means are 100% accurate. And the only way that they can do that is if they can reveal to him what the dream was. That's the only way that he can be assured that what his dream was and what it means, he can trust the interpretation, is if they tell him what it is. And he's so desperate that's what he demands. He's ready to kill everybody. But now he's also ready to turn on a dime and okay, I'll wait. You know, I was going to kill everybody, but fine. Now you think maybe you can interpret it if you just have a little bit of time? Fine, because I just want this interpretation. It's all I really want. And it is God who, as the Chaldean said, no one can do this except the gods. And of course, one thing Daniel's going to do is going to say there is a God, singular, and he's the one who is going to tell you what this dream is, because he's the giver of dreams.
Yeah, yeah. And the section in between verse 17 and 24, or verse 17 to 25. 25 is where Daniel is brought in before the king. Arioch brings him in there finally. Before that, it's you have the section, Daniel goes to his friends, right? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? And Daniel prays, Daniel receives a vision, and then Daniel goes back to Arioch. So you have this stuff coming up, right? So there's a little interlude before we get to the point where there's this, I'm not going to do the killing, right?
Right.
Because you're still at verse 26. Not sure exactly where I'm at. Anyway, you still have a little bit later, you know, Arioch is the one who was supposed to kill, right? But he doesn't end up doing that. He's the king's chief guard. Or captain. And so you have this interlude of Daniel going to the Lord, going to the one true God, and getting answers, and learning what essentially his part is in all of this, at least to some degree. Because he goes in verse 24, he says, therefore Daniel went up to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation. So at that point, you have that transition going on, because now Daniel knows, okay, I can do this because the Lord has revealed it to me. And I mean, obviously he knew that beforehand. He was trusting that the Lord would protect him and his compatriots. And he knew that must have been through the Lord revealing the interpretation to Daniel. And so right at the end of verse 16, and then you lead into this interlude to where Daniel is going to go before the court, go before Nebuchadnezzar, and then you have the interpretation revealed to the king.
Yeah, and the end result is that the king is aware that there is a God that can do what and he might not have admitted this at the time, what the gods of Babylon could not do. There is a God in heaven who interprets dreams. Now, we'll talk about that more, because a lot of that has to do with what the dream is revealing to him. Mm-hmm. Because I think it also stokes his pride. And so he might be more aware of the God of the Hebrews, but he's also more aware of his own importance. And we see how that plays out as well. Mm-hmm. So I think looking at the book as a whole, of Daniel as a whole, God being sovereign is such a strong theme in this book. And right away, right at the beginning, we have this challenge of the Babylonian gods by the true God, who can do what they can't do. And of course, they can't. They're fictitious. They really can't do anything. But yet because what is this going to do? It's going to bring Daniel and his friends, who were not invited to go, now they're going to be brought into prominence. And that's going to play out throughout the book as well. And but it really focuses on the fact that God is the one that is true, that can do what the Babylonian gods cannot. And then as we get more into the dream, we see that God is sovereign not only over Babylon, but God is sovereign over the whole world. And he is sovereign over every empire that's going to rise. That they can't, no, there's no empire in this world that does not exist because God has not allowed it to exist. God has not sovereignly ordained that they would exist, and that they have a purpose. Whether he allows them in their purpose to be one of evil, or if he allows them in their purpose to be a nation that that promotes the gospel, it differs from nation to nation. But God has control of history from beginning to end. And even when, in this case, the people of God are brought into exile because of their own disobedience, and yet they're in exile, and right at the beginning, we are shown that God was not left behind in Israel. He is the God of the universe because he is creator. And so he is there in Babylon, as he is everywhere, controlling all things, being sovereign over all things. And right away, we're going to find out that nothing is going to can happen with all the history that goes on, because this book covers a long history. But God is in control of all of it. And in our own world, we're inundated 24/7 with the politics of the world. And yet, it's good for us to remember that God is sovereign over all things. And when we look at the news or we hear things that that troubles us, we need to remember that this is not outside God's control or sovereignty. And that for us, his people, it can work, it will work for our good and for his glory. And that can be something that can bring us peace.
Well, once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Of course, as always, you can find us at reformedforum.org, where if you do go there, I do encourage you to check out that website. If you haven't recently, you'll notice that there is information about the upcoming annual theology conference. Not upcoming, it's in the fall, of course, but you can register for that now. It's September 27th, 2025. But you'll also note that there is a new course on apologetics that Dr. Camden Busey is teaching. He's called Defending Our Hope. It's a clear and accessible introduction to Reformed apologetics designed to equip believers to respond with biblical clarity and theological depth. I might also add that there is a new book, Union with Christ. It's accompanied by a free video course. So just trying to get some of that information out there about all these wonderful resources for you. You might also note that upcoming in June 4 to June 10, Reformed Forum will have a table at the OPC's General Assembly. Camden and Ryan Noah will be there exhibiting at our 91st General Assembly and Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois. So if you are in the Chicagoland area, you want to come say hey, come say hey. You can also find out more about the congregation that Rob and I serve by checking out westminsteropc.org. There are a couple of new videos there, a welcome video from myself and our other pastor, David Wright. You can check that out at our website, www.westminsteropc.org. Rob, can I guess what's up next time?
that we're going to watch him build the giant statue. We'll at least talk about it.
At least talk about it. All right. Once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.